Thank you, Robin. It's a pleasure to be here. I may have been here for 23 years, but this is actually the first talk I've given in this room. So, now, what I'd like to do is to go through a few of the recent kinds of things that I've been doing, and you'll see a whole bunch of other collaborators on the screen at various times. Janet Pechenik and Craig Maloney is here, and Mike Falk has worked with me a great deal on these things. I'd like to go through this, however, in a way that I want you to think about at each step. What's going on and how we can make, it's close to granular materials, but it isn't there yet. And there's some fundamental questions about how you might convert this at least to behavior of dense granular materials. So I'd like that question to be in the background throughout everything that I'm doing here. Now, I'd like to start though, it would be a good idea if we could douse the lights that are right over here. Would that help? Or well, what about?
Maybe this one.
Are we checking that we could? All right. Is that all right?
No, it's all. Huh? I failed to do it in
those
three.
Yeah. That helps. Yeah. Good. Thanks. The opening remarks are that this is an area, solid mechanics, is an area in which there's an awful lot that remains to be done. Because there are some fundamental questions that we don't know, we'd be surprised that we don't know the answers to. I start with the first one, how do we understand brittle and ductile behaviors from a fundamental point of view? And I mentioned especially in non-crystalline solids, because one of the points that I've been trying to make, and I think I'm right, is that if you're going to understand solid mechanics, meaning how solids fail in various ways, especially by breaking, that it should be easier to understand what goes on non-crystalline solids than these complicated crystalline solids where there are all sorts of anisotropies and dislocation dynamics and things like that. Whereas non-crystalline solids, glassy materials, are, they're pretty close in many ways to liquids. So it ought to be possible to understand them in a more fundamental way. But even this very simple initial question is not really understood. We don't understand the answer to that. If we know, for example, that the difference between brittleness and ductility is not, it's not something like a phase change in a material, because it depends upon the history of how the material is deformed or worked or whatever. Another very interesting question, which I think is going to be sort of below the surface in what I say today, is what's the origin of memory effects? We know that a simple amorphous material can, you know, if I bend it or shear it in some way, it remembers the direction in which it was bent or sheared and behaves differently after that. Well, what is it inside this material that carries that memory? And finally, something I'm not going to talk about at all today, but it's another big question in the kinds of things that we've been doing, is that we know that that brittle fracture is fundamentally unstable. That fracture surfaces, you'll see one in a picture, but that's not going to be the point of today's discussion. That they're always, if it cracks fast enough, that those surfaces are rough. They have all sorts of interesting structure on them that need to be understood. Now, I'm going to talk a lot. This has been the theme picture in talks that I do. By the way, those of you who have been at the physics colloquium I gave a month or so ago will have seen a good deal of this. But here's a molecular dynamics simulation by Mike Falk. It's a two-dimensional material. It's composed of two populations mixed up of circular molecules interacting via Langer-Jones forces. What he's done is he's clamped the top surface and the bottom surface. He's left these side surfaces free. He's pulled up on it. What you're seeing is a pattern of where the deformation occurs. And what Mike's way of visualizing, of understanding where the deformation is occurring, amounts to identifying the location of what we call shear transformation zones. And that name has been in existence for at least 30 years. I think it goes back at least to Ali Argon, but possibly to David Turnbull and Marl Cohn. This is where the action is occurring. It's occurring along the axis of maximum shear stress when you're applying external stresses like that. And what it's doing is it's starting to form something like a shear band. Now, and we'll get back to it maybe a little bit, but what I want you to notice is that what's going on here is a whole sequence, a set of localized transformations. And this is here's a picture that Mike put in his thesis, I guess, 6, 7, 8 years ago. And this is just looking in detail at a system like that, and I'm showing you where and why certain parts of it were made darker. Look, for example, at this cluster of one big and three little atoms there, and what you notice has happened between here and there is that this one has moved in and has become a nearest neighbor of that one, and sort of moved out. It's an elementary shear transformation. It is, in fact, a localized one. This picture is not really the best one to show it, because there's some other ones that have occurred there, and the displacement between here and there, the shear between there and there, has actually gone on for some time. So a whole lot of these things have occurred.
Jim, are these configurations in a joint local minimum under a Langer-Jones potential?
These are molecular dynamics simulations. So they're not doing what Craig Maloney has been doing and actually insisting that they come to a local minimum. They're done at a finite temperature, but a temperature that is almost zero. It's 0.3% of the glass temperature. So he uses a Bose thermostat, knows it's their thermostat. So the thermal fluctuations, there's enough of them there so that the system can age, undergo thermally activated effects, but those thermally activated effects are small, and basically until you get something so that the barrier is very small, nothing's going to happen. Okay?
So you can believe the difference between those.
So what's the rule for generating the shadings?
Well, I didn't want to get into that. That's Falk's way of the dark shade is the degree of non-affine deformation that's occurring. In other words, what he does is, it was very clever. I wish I'd thought of it myself. He looks at all the displacements, and in each little area, he tries to fit it to a string field. And now you know that you can't always do that. So instead of plotting the shear strain or the shear stress or the shear or the compressive strain, etc., he plots the square of how much of an error he makes with the best fit, locally. And that's a way of identifying where transformations have occurred that are different from just simple affine deformations. Is that not that?
Did he test departure from locally affine or globally affine?
Departure from locally affine.
The average over some.
The average is over a certain radius, a circle here.
4 points.
He has to use more than 4 points. Four is the minimum, I guess. It's in two dimensions, I guess, in, you know, left, whatever, yeah. So he, but he looks at each area of, I think you remember 2.6 of the radii of the larger circles, and he takes all the displacements in there and does the best he can to fit that to a strange answer, and then plots the square of the difference. It's very simple. Now, this was the basis for making our version of a shear transformation zone theory of this process. And here's our caricature of what's going on, just like the little oval that I showed you before, is that a simple transformation is one in which I make a transformation from here to there, or I can do it backwards. One of the important things is that if I've made it once in this direction, there's nothing further to go to on that side. Now, let me emphasize that I'm doing something here that's different from what it's what the engineers, the solid mechanics people have been doing for 30 years, more or less. It's different from what I see in most of the granular material literature. What I'm assuming, and what seems to be justified by these molecular dynamic simulations and other things that Craig has done, is that I basically have a material that is a solid. It's an elastic solid, so if I deform it, I can deform it elastically. But there are localized regions that are somehow looser. Those are the shear transformation zones, and that's where the action takes place. That's where the irreversible rearrangements occur. This is an irreversible rearrangement, because in order to get from here to there, I've got to go over some energy barrier and presumably back down again, and so that some energy has to be dissipated in that process. So I'm thinking here of a model that starts with the idea of a non-crystalline solid, but with some sort of localized defects in it. When I'm thinking about an overall shearing or deformation of the thing, I'm not saying that every molecule in there is somehow participating in that. I'm saying that those deformations are occurring only in certain places. Now, once you say that, then you get into this rather interesting picture that, as I just said before, is that it can go one way, but then it can only go back. So you immediately get the understanding of how a system like that can be jammed, because it can. If I've got everybody in the forward position and I try to move in that direction some more, it's going to have a hard time doing that. Whereas it can also move back if I reverse the stress. So I can tell which direction I've strained it in. So here's the mechanism for both jamming and for some memory effect in a relatively simple system that doesn't seem to have an awful lot of structure other than the existence of this population of places where irreversible transformations can occur. And that seems to work. And what I'm going to show you in the next few slides is that it can, in fact, even quite quantitatively and relatively simply explain now a whole body of phenomena in metallic glasses. But again, this goes back to Falk, is that you can now write equations of motion. What Mike and I did to be simple was we assumed that there's just only one rigid set of axes along which these things can be oriented. The whole question of how you can break this to a tensor theory is a different seminar. But you get the basic idea by starting out like this anyway. So what you say is that the plastic strain rate is the rate of forward transitions minus the rate of backward transitions times the, you know, the density of these things at which transitions are occurring. The interesting question now is, well, how do I write a master equation for the density of the plus and minus STZs? And I do that by saying, well, obviously, I can convert pluses to minuses or vice versa, which is essentially the same thing as the strain rate, I've got the, you know, this piece of the equation. However, what, and again, this is a fault idea, what you have to do is realize that there's going to be some rate at which I'm creating new ones of these things and annihilating the existing ones. So what we did was we added a term to this master equation for the densities of the zones that said that I have a creation rate, which this is just a notation, n infinity is a reference density. And the important thing is that there's a gamma function here, and the whole question is going to be, well, what is this gamma? What is the coefficient in front of that rate? What we do is, in this level, this is a zero temperature version of the theory, we say that, well, this process has to drive this thing to some sort of an equilibrium steady state. So n infinity is basically the equilibrium density of these things. Equilibrium or steady state under persistent shearing, which is important. And so this is the creation and that's the annihilation rate. And then the question is, what is that thing? Well, we had all kinds of problems figuring that out. Before I show you how Leonard Petchnik pointed out what the solution should be, I thought I should just introduce a little bit of notation. Because you see, what I've also done now is I've introduced internal state variables, which is, in this case, somewhat different from what had been in the older versions of these theories. One is simply the density of the STZs, n plus plus n minus normalized to this n infinity. I call that capital lambda. But the new one is this difference between, in this case, n minus minus n plus, which I think is consistent with the notation that I'm using here. Also normalized to n infinity. So that tells me an orientational bias. That's the term that's going to contain the memory of what's happened before. It's also the term that becomes a tensor in a more general version of the theory. So if the lambda and delta are going to be the internal state variables that we try to find a dynamical theory.
The equations you gave us, they were cooked up, but they need to conserve the lambda.
No.
Looked like.
No. In fact, here.
Because of the gamma term.
The gamma term, that's creation and that's annihilation. So if I, for example, if I don't have anything at all, then it sort of creates it. It will drive the total density to n infinity.
But if the total density sits on n infinity?
If the total density sits on n infinity, I'm just switching from one orientation to the other. But the total density doesn't have to sit at infinity, and that's going to come in a big way in another slide or two.
There's nothing in the equations
that can
be written down to
ever
drive it away from
it. That's right. This equation will always, at least so long as I maintain gamma as being positive, which some of my engineering colleagues didn't do, this will always run towards an infinity, that's right. So what capital?
I don't see anything in the equations that we're ever picking up out of that. Because the other terms are concerned.
That's exactly right, is that if it gets there, then it has reached some sort of steady state. And if I turn the driving off here, At this moment, this theory doesn't have anything in it that will allow the material to age. That's absolutely right, and that comes in a slide after this. But I do want to mention this non-trivial business of how you figure out what gamma has to be. And actually, it's a little bit more convincing in a later version of this, but this is what Leonard Petchnik realized, is that if you use, basically impose the second law of thermodynamics, and then use the concept that, well, what you're doing is you're driving the system, you're putting energy into it, that energy is sort of being dissipated, and the way that dissipated energy is being contained in the system, the way it's sort of storing heat, if you like, is in the disorder of this of amorphous material. As you shear it, if you start with a low disorder, you increase the disorder because you're making these atoms, you know, rearrange themselves. And so you'll be increasing the disorder. And so what Leonard conjectured was that the total rate at which you're dissipating energy should be proportional to this rate at which this gamma function that comes in as a coefficient of the annihilation and creation terms. And this conjecture, it satisfies all of your fundamental principles, especially because I can now insist that this be a positive term. And if you stick that in, and we use, this is not just the first law of thermodynamics, it's some sort of an internal energy that's a function of these order parameters, plus the dissipation rate, lo and behold, you get a unique, essentially unique, is that you can adjust one constant in there. Expression for gamma, and it looks exactly what you think it would look like, because if you think about it, okay, this is just the strain rate, so it's proportional to the strain rate squared, which is important, and you know, it's got some other factors in it that are okay, but there's this other very interesting feature, is that it has lambda squared minus delta squared there. Which immediately tells you that dynamically, somehow this is dropping out of the analysis. That if I start with delta, it should always be less than lambda. And if I ever got delta near lambda, it would have to move away because it was encounter a sort of a dynamic barrier. So here's an approximate, this is what we call the quasi-linear approximation, where we assume that the driving force is just proportional to the stress in units of law. I call it the yield stress there, but that's just a number that comes out of the theory. But if you now look at the steady state equations, and here's what this gamma thing happens to be, and by the way, here you see I've already rather taken lambda equal to 1, but I can adjust the by changing the stress, changing the driving, I can make them move around still. So the equation in motion for the strain rate is just sigma minus delta, and there's a line in the delta sigma plane along which the material is jammed because the strain rate is zero. There's another line, this is the equation for delta, there's another line in which I have a non-zero strain rate, but the delta has gone to a fixed point, where sigma is equal to 1 over delta. That's this curve. They cross at this thing that we've identified as a yield stress. A little bit more analysis tells you that this is the stable set of states below the yield stress. This is the stable, dynamically stable set of states above the yield stress. And there's this natural barrier that says that delta can't get bigger than 1, so lambda is 1. And so you have an exchange of stability. If I apply a small stress, everybody gets jammed and nothing happens and it doesn't flow. Whereas if I apply a bigger stress, above this yield stress value, all of a sudden it starts moving because I have a steady state solutions in which I have flow in the material.
So with the definitions of delta and lambda, this lambda squared rate minus delta squared would be zero. This just means it has to be a positive number of n plus.
Well, look, that's, again, what, if you look at this, gamma has to be positive. Okay, that's going to happen if delta is less than 1.
But going back to the original n variable, this is just the requirement that they're both positive, isn't it?
That's exactly right. That's it. But again, it sort of drops out of, of the analysis. You don't sweat to put it in. What you do sweat to put in is that you have to choose the internal energy so that this is always positive. But it seems to drop out remarkably naturally. And then here's, I'm going to use this plot again in a minute. Here's the low temperature limit, which is all that I've been talking about. So the engineers always do the stress as a function of strain rate, rather than, I would always do it backwards. The stress is the driving force and the strain rate is the response. So what this is telling me is that up to stresses of order 1, I get nothing happens, and then I have some sort of a curve in this very simple algebraic version of the model. Where the strain rate goes up with the stress above the yield stress. Now, I want to jump to real data. The remarkable set of papers by Bill Johnson and colleagues at Caltech, and what they've done is they figured out a way of making this is called Vitreloy 1. Which is a 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 component metallic glass, and the big point about it is that they can make it in bulk. They're making golf clubs and medical devices out of this material or similar materials, they have remarkable properties. There's a little demonstration that my grandson was telling me about. He'd seen once. I know what that is. They made little spheres of this material, and they showed if you drop it, it bounces right back up. Essentially no coefficient of restitution, or one coefficient, whatever. You try that thing. Same thing with a really nice steel. It goes plunk. It's a remarkable material. But what's most remarkable is these folks have done experiments measuring, because they wanted to know how to form this material. So they did experiments over 5 decades of strain rates and a bunch of different temperatures. Here's a picture. Again, I've put Mike's picture there, but they make these bulk materials. See, that's a millimeter, and then they push, because if they pull, what they're going to do is they're going to find any kind of little micro crack, and it's going to break that way. You don't want that to happen. But they push, and it does indeed fracture along the 45-degree axis. Well, but that's not what I'm so interested in here. Is that what I want to talk about here is that if they do this in situations where it doesn't break, and here's one where it broke, and that's when they were pulling it very fast, but if they pull it slowly, what it will do is it'll go through a maximum. This is now plotting the stress as a function of the strain, not the strain rate. Initially they have to pull harder in order to get it going, but finally it settle down to something that looks like a constant strain rate. This is, as the time goes on and they're doing this at constant strain rate, it's getting into a steady state. And they've got measurements of these steady state values of the strain rate as a function of stress or vice versa. Here they are, and as I say, about 5 decades of strain rate. And the data is, like Bill Johnson and I have been going around on this quite a bit, but there's a lot of scatter and problems with the data, but the basic picture is looking very good. As if you look here at the low strain rate, low stress region, this is log plot, of course, that what you're seeing is it's viscous creep. It's linear viscosity of the material. The strain rate is proportional to the stress, or the deviatoric, the shear stress, if you like. But then what happens is that as you go up in applied stress, so that you get the higher strain rates, the thing bends over. And that happens sooner if you're doing it at the higher temperatures here. And what they've been calling this is that the thing, say, is making a transition to a state where it's behaving superplastically. And the whole question is, well, how can you understand superplasticity? And of course, that's what they're interested in. That's where they can form the golf clubs very nicely.
So what does that mean, superplasticity?
That's a name, maybe. I'll show you what it, I think it really is. In fact, I'm quite sure it really is. In just a second. Because in fact, what I said to myself as soon as I saw those pictures was that I could understand them, in fact, without doing any calculations. This is just the first paper that Mike and Lynn and I wrote on this, which is what we call defect dynamics. The one that I like and I'm going to talk about mostly here is a more recent paper where I used an effective temperature idea to make the theory fit together in a way that I like better. And then I just wanted to remark that Anel Lemaitre and I have actually got a PhysRev letter accepted for publication with a sort of STZ-based mechanical type model of why you get these super Arrhenius, very long, why the viscosity looks as if it diverges in the neighborhood of a glass temperature. I think we got it accepted too easily. If somebody here is a referee, that's fine, because every time I've had a paper that was looked that speculative that was accepted too easily, it turned out to be wrong. So I was hoping for a much bigger fuss. Okay, here's my eyeball way of explaining that data. This is the picture I just showed before. But now, what happens if I say that there's some thermal fluctuation going on? Well, if there's some thermal fluctuation going on, then what I know is that at small stresses, although in my zero temperature version nothing happens, but there ought to be some creep that occurs there. So I just here, this is an eyeball picture. I'll show you a real picture in a minute. And so I just sort of added some points that stay along that curve above the yield stress that say that there's a small amount of thermal creep below the yield stress at some finite temperature. And now the point is that there's an awful lot of decades between here and there. And so if you plot that on the log plot, the way we were doing before, and forget about this piece of it, that looks very much like the experimental pictures. So what I said is that, look, I bet that what they're seeing is that the thing is just hitting this dynamic yield stress and therefore starting to flow a lot faster in the neighborhood of that dynamic yield stress. So the question is, well, how do you make a theory that does that? Well, this is their data again. And I'm jumping ahead. That's my theoretical fit to it.
You've got no data in the region that's most interesting for me.
Right.
So,
well,
You said I could immediately see how thick this data, but...
Well, all I'm saying is it bends over. Okay, and the question is, how many parameters do I need to fit, how far it's bent over? And how credible are those, those parameters? Basically, the answer is I need one. What are you going to do? That's why I'm begging these people to do better experiments. These experiments are not all that great,
So when you saw the curves in the upper left that bend over, then you knew that the ones at the bottom right would also bend over.
Well, there's evidence that they're doing that. They're bending over. And the bending over a pretty wide range. Remember, that, you go over that range of temperatures, you're bending over a very big range of viscosities. This is the real world, and I'm really very interested in more careful experiments because there's all sorts of places where this theory can come across.
Well, are metallic glasses the best way?
No, I don't think so. I don't think so. One of the reasons that I would very much like, and I've been drumming on the folks with the new MRL proposal here. I've got my name in it, but this is not where I want to talk about that. But they're trying to do models of things like colloidal suspensions, I think, would be a lot better, or some of these arrays of biologically interesting cells. I think it can be done in soft materials, and I think it would be very interesting to do it in soft materials. Foam materials and things like that. But what I also would like to think about is that I think it might even be easier to do it in maybe wet granular materials, and maybe even dry granular materials. I'm not sure. But anything where I can control the parameters better than I can control the parameters for these metallic glasses, which of course, with that many components, what you also worry about is that as you do the experiment, the compositional, local compositional changes are occurring, or phase separating.
Okay, but those systems you just listed are very different from each other. Some will have could have significant thermally
active
creep, and the others wouldn't.
That's right.
Isn't that a central element of the theory?
Well, the point I'm trying to make here is that I think that we must be able to make a theory that there's questions in which the thermal activation is not a central element. Okay?
The strain rate is not really determined by thermal energy at all.
Well, I'm going to talk about let me get to something towards the end of the talk. Something I mentioned just also very briefly when I was chatting with you a couple of weeks ago in that session with Gino and us. I think those are all interesting. Let me just mention how you put the temperature, the thermal fluctuations into this. There's one way of doing it. Remember this equation. This looks very much the same as before. This is what I call the master equation. And here's where the gamma was, and there was nothing, no factor there. And so what am I doing? The first thing I'm doing is I'm saying that the gamma is the part that is driven by the mechanical work you're doing on it and the rate at which you're dissipating that energy. So this goes away if the material is just acidic. And what I needed was an extra term that was going to allow the material to age at the thermal fluctuations, would just allow it to relax in some way. So that's what I call rho of T. The other term that I need is that if I'm going to be at finite temperature, I'm not going to be in a regime where I always have to drive the total density of SDZs this normalized quantity 1 in infinity. And so what I say here is that what I want to do is I want to drive it to something which is something like a Boltzmann distribution. In other words, I want this to be a detailed balance term. It says that as the material, you know, goes on, either aging or driven through deformations, that there's some sort of Boltzmann distribution of the population of the STZs. But I want to say that that Boltzmann distribution does not necessarily contain the ordinary thermal temperature. But, and now here I want to elaborate on this, that this is where, exactly where in this kind of a theory there ought to be an effective temperature, which talks about the disorder of the configurational degrees of freedom and not the thermal vibrations. And that effective temperature can in fact fall out of equilibrium with the ordinary bath temperature. So, rho is this thermally assisted, generally it's going to be a superlinear fluctuation rate. Chi is the effective temperature in order, in units of some formation energy of the STZs. That will be an interesting parameter to figure out. So we need a way to deduce the function rho. That turns out to be pretty easy. But mostly we need an equation of motion and an interpretation for the effective temperature. To get rho, you just use those equations of motion. Let me do this quickly. You can easily get that small strain, small stress limit, small strain rate limit, where it's linear, and so that the Newtonian viscosity has this factor of rho in it. It also has this activation factor in it. And it's not too hard to go and deduce up to, you know, rho, at least there's a scale factor that has to be determined.
Could you just be clear about temperature? Because previous slide, we had T effective and T.
I say these are all T's. Okay, these are all real T's. This is the, you know, the bath temperature, the kind of thing that you can control with a thermostat, with an ordinary thermostat. Okay, and this is the standard version of the viscosity as a function of temperature for these, for this vitriol one material. And you know, this is many decades. Each of these is two decades. So it really goes very well. But if you look closely here, you also notice that there's a lot of scatter in that, in those numbers, which of course comes up and hits you because there's scatter on the log scale.
So what's the materials being described?
This is the same one, this five components thing with vitro water one. They've done all these experiments on. The basic idea of the effective disorder temperature, as you said before, is that the slowly changing configurational states be disordered, that state of disorder ought to be, at least in these things. And I'm curious, again, I'm puzzled about how to make the connection with granular materials or some of the other things that Jerry was talking about. So, now I can talk about this as a temperature as long as I'm thinking about energies. And so I can think about the disordered states as having different energies. Now I ought to be able to, obviously I'm thinking of the Edwards kinds of ideas, but it's not clear how to generalize that. It ought to be possible not to have to deal with energy interaction. I point out here that these disordered degrees of freedom can maximize some sort of an entropy, therefore they should be characterized by temperature. More than that, I assume that the STZs are disordered fluctuations that are way out in the wings of this distribution, and therefore I should be able to say that they're rather rare, and therefore they should have a distribution proportional with this Boltzmann factor. But now, of course, that's a dynamical quantity. Here's back to my canonical picture from Falk. You've seen this picture before. But here, what he's done is exactly the same configuration, but instead of plotting the STZ, the non-affine activity, here he's just plotting, the blue is regions in which there's dilation, and the red are regions in which there's contraction. And this is an old issue, because many of the, almost all of the theories of plastic deformation in this material say that the shear band is going to be a region in which there is excess free volume. And I don't see that here. What I do see, the yellow line sort of show up, is that region certainly looks as if it has more disorder. It has both blue and red regions. It might be a slight excess of free volume, but not. It's not noticeable. And the most important thing that characterizes this region in which the shear flow is occurring is the degree of density fluctuations in that region, which makes me think that the idea of the effect of temperature makes sense. Now, I do want to... How much more time do you want to take?
Fairly indulgent.
Okay, well,
how much longer do you think
we'll probably not more than 10 or 15 minutes. Depends on how many questions you ask me. You should ask me lots of questions. Okay. Nobody wants to stay that long. Here's I do want to mention the stuff that Durian and Ryu Signagel have been doing. This is now getting a little bit old, but this is this model of a sheared foam. And it's a numerical model. But that looks sort of like the kind of thing that we're talking about. These are balls or circles, and in this case they have some elasticity and some friction coefficient. But what they did was they made measurements of the temperature of this material as a function of the strain rate. Their strain rate is gamma dot epsilon. And now what do they mean by temperature? Obviously that's not a model that has a real thermal temperature in it. They measure the temperature by a whole bunch of different, four or five independent thermometers. The one that I like best, I'll use in a second, is just using the Stokes-Einstein relationship between the viscosity and the diffusion constant. The ratio of the viscosity and diffusion constant is supposed to be the temperature. And so they just measured those things and plotted it as temperature. And then they did various other fluctuation measurements and deduced the temperature. They got the same temperature out of all this. And what they discovered is that as they go to smaller and smaller strain rates, shear rates, they get slower and slower, because they have to wait longer and longer to get the data to do that, this temperature settles down to a non-zero constant. There's some sort of an effective equilibrium steady state temperature in the system. It's a measure of the disorder as they shear, and it seems to have a unique value, which Andrea thinks ought to be interpreted as something like a glass temperature for this foam. I find that really quite interesting, because it looks to me as if it's exactly what we're seeing in these STZ models, and in particular, the idea that this effective temperature that I introduced before goes to some constant in the limit of persistent deformation, looks to me to be quite intriguing.
What kind
is the effective temperature that I introduced in the previous example for the metallic glasses?
So.
This is T, and
the same thing.
It's the same thing, but it was a different normalization. Okay. So, what I want to mention here is that the SDZ-like theories, you have a sort of natural interpretation in terms of the effect of temperature and the Stokes-Einstein theorem. There's a subtlety I'm not going to discuss here, but Robin or Jerry or somebody will probably bring it up. But now, if I'm thinking about the viscosity and I define it as the stress divided by the strain rate, for these materials that have some sort of jamming transition, then this is going to diverge as the inverse of the strain rate. The diffusion constant in general is some length squared times a rate, and the only rate in the problem, the only relevant rate in that problem is indeed the strain rate. The whole thing you have to think about, I may strain slower and slower, but really the effective amount of deformation that's producing the disorder is indeed the amount of deformation, the strain I get to. And therefore, if I use the Stokes-Einstein theorem, I can use that as a way of calculating it. Eliminate the strain rate between these two relations and get the effective temperature is just proportional to some constant of the material property. The yield stress times the characteristic lengths cubed. And if you think about that, that's sort of like the energy that's associated with flipping the STZs from one orientation to another. And so that's exactly the kind of energy that you think would be associated with a regular glass temperature. So this gives me an estimate, a ballpark estimate, not a very good one, but within an order of magnitude of what I think the effective temperature ought to be, and I'm going to call that time. Yeah.
A question on this glass
temperature.
I'm not clear. The in your model, this effective temperature is a parameter which appears since the beginning to describe the relaxation.
Yeah.
In your other paper with you and the others, this is measured in some way, so it's not built in the model. So, what sense do you say, why do you call this the equivalent of that temperature which emerged from? It's not just a parameter in your model to describe the stages of the system.
Well,
under some condition.
I'm putting it in a different. You're thinking of the paper that Falk and Benchenik and I wrote first, which we called on an earlier slide. I called it defect dynamics. And that one, we used a sort of a constant temperature independent equilibrium density of the STZs. That we knew at the time couldn't be right because we were not going to get out of that version of the theory, for example, couldn't begin to describe the differential standing calorimetry experiment in some of these materials. So we really had to do something better than that. And the way that I like to do it now is via this effective temperature idea. But here what I'm saying is I'm going to, in the next transparency, in the next slide, I'm going to say, okay, I know what role this plays. I have some sort of a first principles order of magnitude estimate for it. Now I'm going to stick this into an equation of motion for the car and see what comes out. But I'm not sure I answered your question.
Try to rephrase it.
Okay.
If you take a glass and you have a glass temperature, and this is the parameter which enters all the equation, the dynamics and so on.
Yeah.
Will you score that even though you have precise bath temperature, if you measure fluctuation, dissipation, or stochastic correlation, you get another quantity. Instead, in your model, this is the parameter you are plugging in since the very beginning. So I don't understand why this is an effective temperature, not any parameter.
Okay, let's go back. If I think about a glass, and I let the glass really be in thermodynamic equilibrium, then basically there should be just one temperature. The effective temperature idea comes in only when I'm deforming it, when I'm doing something mechanical that is inducing atomic rearrangements within the material. And under those conditions, you see, I can say that the configurational degrees of freedom can fall out of thermal equilibrium with the heat there. Okay. So what I'm saying here is that since I'm primarily interested in the properties of these materials when they deform, that I need a parameter, I need some sort of a dynamical variable that is going to tell me, ultimately, locally in the material, what the state of deserter is. And I'm hypothesizing that I can use an effective temperature to do that. Okay?
You are not deriving the effective temperature, you are introducing.
I'm very introducing. In a certain sense, this is a derivation, but it's only an order of magnitude hand waving derivation, and you have to think a lot harder than I've made you think in order to even get it to look like that. But what it is a plausibility argument that says there's something like this in the material.
Are you thinking the effective temperature is something which, well, you said it measures the state of local disorder.
Yeah.
But the disorder arises in some sense from the shear. But are you thinking of it as being a causal element in the shearing process as well?
Exactly. Is
it the cause or is it the result?
Yeah. But you see, it's both. Here, for example, let me jump, because I think I can illustrate the answer to that question by jumping way ahead on something. The old idea, long discredited, about why shear bands should form, why should there be an instability of shear banding, was that, well, if I start shearing more rapidly in some local region, that's going to dissipate more energy, it's going to get hotter there. The hotter it gets, the more deformable it becomes. And that's the nature of the instability. Okay? Now, that doesn't work because thermal conductivity is so enormously fast, and the rates at which I'm doing this are so slow that that would tell you that in a little sample your shear bands would have characteristic length scales that would be in the meters. Everybody knows that doesn't work. Okay. One of the nice things that comes out of this concept, that appeals to me at least, is that, well, look, it's not the ordinary temperature that's heating up in that shear band. It's this configurational disorder temperature, this effective temperature, which is indeed good. Because I'm shearing, I'm disordering it. But as I disorder it, I'm also affecting, and that's coming out in the equations of motion, I'm affecting the response to shear. Okay? And now, because the configurational disorder temperature must have a very much smaller diffusion constant, because it really requires the atomic rearrangements on the vibrations. And Anthony Fogler has actually made some estimates of this. You can get perfectly reasonable estimates of shear banding instability, which we're very eager to be pursuing in various other ways.
Temperatures ultimately related to stress, and it should be transferred through the system.
Not necessarily. Well, stress, of course, transmits itself through these systems almost instantaneously. If I think about, okay, I've got some atoms that are sort of out of order here, can they transmit their out of order to their neighbors? That can be very, very slow.
But wouldn't it be then more natural to write in terms of strain, because strain is what is disrupting the system?
The strain, look, you have to be very careful now. Because you see, you don't want to think about certainly the plastic strain as being any kind of order parameter in the system. That's another mistake I make. Some of my engineering friends are angry because I pointed that out to them. They shouldn't do that. Let's go out a little bit. So here's the equation of motion. It's for the effect of temperature. And here's the first term. I say, okay, I'm driving it. I've got to put in something like a density of SCD, times a gamma, and I'm driving it towards kinetic energy. And then there's going to be another term, and this is the aging term. It says that in the absence of driving, and this is zero, I'm going to relax to the bath temperature. And the rate at which I'm going to relax to the bath temperature is going to be the same rho of t, this sort of super Arrhenius kind of a rate at which the real temperature, real thermal fluctuations drive rearrangements, which of course can be very, very slow. Now, here I'm pointing out that really the only adjustable parameter in this theory, apart from a rate factor, is this quantity here. It's really more properly, this density of these relaxation fluctuation sites, which we don't know. But in fact, if you think about it, the real adjustable parameters, it's quantity kappa times e to the minus this parameter over chi infinity. So there's basically only one number to adjust to deal with the experiments, as you know.
You're getting confused between chi and t. I thought that chi was basically...
Chi is the effective temperature,
and
T is the real temperature.
And so, for instance, in the shield form, nominal T would be zero.
T would be zero.
Yeah, but you said in that case you expect that.
But nothing happens unless I'm shear.
I'm sorry, but you wrote T is shear.
I don't have a T. Well,
it's the effective there, but that's what you really mean.
But chi is a dimensionless version of T effective. So I thought it was, by putting T effective here, it would help people understand what I was saying without remembering for sure what chi was. Okay? So that's a...
But it turns out in the shear form project, even if the bath temperature is zero in practice, chi wouldn't go to zero, go to a finite constant, even for a small shear rate.
That's fine. Yeah.
So instead you're assuming in your model that chi would relax to the real temperature.
If there is a real temperature and if this is zero, this is...
Well, sure.
Okay, now the point is that in the foam measurements, everything here is zero. But this is not. And so the chi is going to relax to this chi infinity. Now there's another question, why should at higher strain rates, why should chi go up? And there you have to think pretty carefully about what time constants are in your system. Think about that, what you realize is that in their systems, there's a time constant associated with the friction, how long it takes for the transformation to occur, and their strain rates can be quite comparable to that inverse time.
What? The first part of your equation should be red line, no? Because gamma should be very, very small. If I understand that I'm asking, in the shear form experiment, chi wouldn't go to infinity, that is to say, the effective temperature wouldn't go to zero. It goes, even if the shear rate is very, very small, it goes to finite failure.
That's right.
Instead, here, this is not the case.
Exactly.
Because if the first term is absent,
in other words, if you're not shearing it,
if you're not shearing or shearing very, very late.
Yeah, well, then nothing happens in the foam.
Nothing happens at all?
Okay, I have no mechanism in this equation If I sort of quench the foam, I don't have any draining mechanism or anything like that here. Then if I quench it, stopping the shearing, then I get what I get, whatever is there, and there's no dynamic.
No, but this is the point, because in the foam, you wouldn't get at zero temperature, even if the shear rate is practically zero.
Yeah.
This is because this is sort of, there is an underlying, an underlying endless light temperature of this kind of thing.
Yeah.
Instead, in this case, I got the impression, in this model, this is not the case. As I said, your effective temperature, if the shear is very small, will go always to the real bath temperature. No chance to get something different from that.
If I have a non-zero bath temperature, and remember the foams effectively have a really zero bath temperature. And, I do it on a computer and I don't put a temperature in, or I do it in a real experiment, or with a granular material, or other things that are large, where the real thermal fluctuations are utterly negligible. Okay?
Yes. Okay.
Then what I'm saying is that this mimics at least the small strain rate, steady state properties of the foam. Okay. So that's what I've done, and here's a picture that I showed you before, and this is, you get with that one, essentially single parameter fit, you get a pretty reasonable account of this broad range of experiments.
What is the parameter that is being fitted?
It's that kappa that is in the previous. And that is, here I put beta equals 1, and then kappa equals 2.
And beta?
If I said beta equals 1, then it's physics in this. That tells me that the sites at which I have this kind of equilibration of the effective temperature towards the real temperature are the same as the SDZ sites, are they the same density as the SDZ sites. It's very interesting, as we'll see in a second, to say, well, look, maybe those sites are more populous, in which case this beta parameter could be less than 1. And that's what gives me an interesting instability. But this is done with this beta equals 1 and kappa, I think, turned out to be 2. And that's it. Apart from the time constant, which sort of sets the time scale, that's the only parameter you stick in this theory. Of course, what you're doing is you're assuming that this is the yield stress across there. The tensile stress, and because that's what comes out of the theory, and you could, in fact, say, well, the yield stress is temperature dependent, and so I could improve the fit if you wanted, but neither the theory or the experiments are good enough to push in that direction. Now we get a reasonable, this looks sort of like that. This is stress strain curves with the overshoot. The overshoot you can understand has to do with the fact that you started with a fairly ordered system of experiments that quench the material, and therefore there's an overshoot in your stress before it settles down, and you've generated enough SDZs or enough disorder in the system to allow it to get into state. Well, I don't know, there are various possibilities of things that occur here. Also, this particular steady state value is one of the ones that's sort of off the, Johnson thinks he's made a mistake in the temperature.
Yes, sorry.
Yes.
In your model, if you change the strain in some way, and then suppose at that given strain you stop increasing the strain, you expect that those curves should move one top of the other toward
No. What happens is that that's another whole set of kinds of things that you can do in the model, and it works pretty well. But you have to be careful. If you've got it here, and then you unload it quickly, what you do is you come down to some place here, and there's a residual stream.
If you keep the strain
at some value, yeah, then in fact the stress will relax.
You relax too.
Is
this the case also in the experiment?
Yes. However, for this particular material, neither Johnson nor I understand it, is that the exponential rate at which the stress relaxes. I think that's an idea about why it may happen, but there's a very simple formula for what that ought to be, and it's wrong by a factor of 20 to 30. So the stress relaxation, there's something wrong, but it's apparently wrong with the experiment. So we've got to sort that out. Maybe the experiments were not done in precisely the way Johnson thought he was doing. Interesting point. Here, if I make that beta function less than 1, it's a half. This is the effective temperature in steady state as a function of the stress. And that's the way to do it, because if I do a simple shear experiment, the stress is constant across the thing. And what you see is that at lower temperatures, you start getting this S-shaped curve, so you have multiple solutions. And in fact, what happened is that if I look along this curve and I set it at a strain rate, say, with a stress that corresponds to this, I'll have a low temperature and a high temperature region in coexistence with each other, and that's, of course, it looks like a shear rate. So that is an intriguing possibility. And then, I said you can do differential scanning, calorimetry curves. Unfortunately, here I don't have any direct experiments to compare with. Let me not get out of that. I did want to finish. Now I'm going a little bit longer than you wanted, but the good questions. Here's some stuff that Bill Johnson has. I think he's about to, he's trying to publish in his reverse. And I find absolutely fascinating, although I don't, he and I are sort of arguing about the interpretation. This is a whole bunch of metallic glasses. And this is the yield stress. And again, exactly how we're measuring yield stress, I'm not sure. An order of magnitude is okay, as a function of the shear modulus, so that the slope of this curve is the shear strain at which the thing yields. And the message from this is that the shear, this all looks as if it lies pretty accurately on a linear curve of slope, 0.027 or something like that. Which makes it look as if what's universal in these materials is not, certainly not a yield stress, but a yield strength. And here's another picture that Johnson plots, and here I really don't agree with him. He's trying to make a theory of it. Just look at the data. And what he's done here is he's looked at the temperature dependence of the yield stress, pointing out that this number, it's of the order of 0.02, and it seems to be going up to something of the order of 0.03 or 0.035 at lower temperatures. Looks like there's a slightly temperature dependent yield strain that looks as if it's universal. How would you find a universal yield strain for a material like this? Well, what does that mean? Well, it immediately means to me, I think, that what's important is geometry, not the forces so much. And in particular, if that's true, then what's happening is that I should think of these materials, even the metallic glasses, as they yield, at least, as finding some sort of geometric configuration of the SDZs with an overall strain at just 0.02, 0.03, at which all of a sudden they are able to move around each other. Now that, you know, if that picture is right, what that says is that, you know, I'm not so interested in, you know, the attractive interactions that hold the thing together for this purpose, but I do seem to be interested in is the hard cores that produce the dominant geometry. And if it's only the hard cores that are important, then it ought to be able, it ought to look very much like some sort of a granular material. There ought to be some universal property. Now, Bill, actually, you showed me, and he hasn't even attempted to publish it. He can add to this graph, way up in here, structural glasses. And they're all on pretty much the same curves. It's more scatter. You can sort of understand why there might be scatter. Is it, after all, a lot of things that are geometric that could come in, if I had a material with a very wide dispersion of sizes of the atoms, I would expect to have probably
something. Is this temperature dependent? Is it a bit of a problem if you want to describe this as a geometric effect?
A bit, yeah. Except that, you know, I could imagine that what's going on is that I get to some. No, you're right. It is indeed a problem, because if I was trying to imagine that what was happening was that I get to some place where I go over a barrier, and I need thermal activation to get over that barrier, then I would expect now to be bringing the nature of the forces back in. Now, Johnson had another way of, that's where he gets this T to the three-hand out, two-thirds of this. And I don't believe a word of it. And you can quote me, so I told him that. It's, you know, it's an interesting question, and it's probably way out of it.
Jim,
yeah.
Is that the last transparency?
Well, there's one transparency that says, let's say just what I said here, that we might have some similarity between these things, and then it leads me to think, well, if I really have to talk about things that are more nearly granular materials, maybe I'd better get back to the Edwards interpretation of effective temperature. But then what I don't know how to do is how to write down an equation of motion for that effective temperature, because I don't even know how to start the theory, because I don't know how to, where's the analog of using the first and second law of thermodynamics? And I'm comfortable, I'm talking about energy here, but am I feeding volume in? But I don't want to feed volume in, because I don't think that's what's doing it. What am I doing as I deform the material to change that Edwards kind of effective temperature?
I understand what the yield stress is, but I don't understand what a universal yield strain is, because presumably the strain varies during the yielding.
No, what you're doing, again, you have to listen carefully when I say I don't understand how he's even defining his yield stress. But presumably what he's doing is he's doing a very slow deformation and looking at the stress strain curve, and then that's going to bend over someplace, and he's going to identify that bend over as the yield stress. And of course, he knows what the shear modulus is, and therefore there's a strain at which that bend together. And now it looks to me as if, okay, I make a picture of some something like a molecular dynamic simulation of that process, and it's going to look the same, maybe on different scales. That I can blow it up or compress it or something like that. But every one of these materials, when I put it on the same scale, is going to have the same amount of deformation, amount of strain at the place that it yields. More or less.
I'm very happy for the discussion to go on, but I'm also conscious that we should come back. Yeah. Well,
yeah.
We need to stay.
Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you very much.